The debate over Darwinian evolution is typically framed by the news media as a clash between right and left. Conservatives are presumed to be critical of Darwin's theory, while liberals are presumed to be supportive. As in most cases, reality is more complicated. There always have been liberal critics of Darwin. In the early 20th century, there was the progressive reformer just mentioned, William Jennings Bryan, who fought for women's suffrage, world peace, and against Darwin. More recently, late left-wing novelist Kurt Vonnegut, self-described secular humanist, called our human bodies miracles of design and faulted scientists for pretending they have the answer as how we got this way when natural selection couldn't possibly have produced such machines. Just as there have been critics of Darwin on the left, there continues to be champions of Darwin on the right. In the last few years, George Will, Charles Krauthammer, and John Derbyshire, along with social scientist James Q. Wilson, and of course, political theorist Larry Arnhart, have stoutly defended Darwin's theory. Some are even promoting Darwinian biology as a way to save conservatism. Now, the allure of conservative sort of Darwinism or Darwinian conservatism is not hard to understand. While 19th century giants such as Karl Marx and Sigmund Freud have been debunked, Darwin retains his prestige among the elites as a secular saint. Moreover, Darwinists have clothed themselves in the mantle of modern science, successfully stigmatizing those who criticize them as bigoted Bible thumpers who are anti-science. No wonder a number of conservative intellectuals have either refrained from becoming involved in the debate over Darwinism or have taken the side of Darwin as a matter of course. It's unfashionable or even embarrassing to be on the side of Darwin's critics, and who wants to be unfashionable or embarrassed? Other more thoughtful conservatives are troubled by what they regard as the excesses of Darwinian ideologues, but they seem to think that they can tame or neutralize Darwinian evolution by redefining it. For example, physicist Stephen Barr has argued in First Things that neo-Darwinism, properly understood, need not require a process that is unguided or unplanned. The word random, as used in science, does not mean uncaused, unplanned, or inexplicable, he writes. It means uncorrelated. The problem is not that Dr. Barr is wrong about the appropriate meaning of random, but that mainstream Darwinists do not accept his point and never have. Darwinism from the start has been defined as an undirected process. That's its core. That's why Darwin himself emphasized that no shadow of reason can be assigned for the belief that variations were intentionally and specially guided. In the Darwinian view, biological structures, such as the vertebrate eye or the wings of butterflies or the bacterial flagellum, must have developed through the interplay of chance, random mutations as understood by modern Darwinists, and necessity, natural selection or survival of the fittest, which was coined by Herbert Spencer, but actually Charles Darwin thought it was a better description of natural selection than his term, and so he started using it in a later edition of The Origin. So in the same hold true not just for the lower animals, but also for the higher animals, like us. In the words of Harvard paleontologist George Gaylord Simpson, man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind. Or in the words of 38 Nobel laureates who wrote the hapless Kansas Board of Education in 2005, evolution is, quote, the result of an unguided, unplanned process of random variation and natural selection. Those who think that the atheist views of someone like Richard Dawkins are somehow atypical among evolutionary biologists live an overly sheltered life. Dawkins' views are alarmingly prosaic among evolutionists. He's just more open about his underlying beliefs. In fact, nearly 95% of biologists in the US National Academy of Sciences identify themselves as either atheists or agnostics, far more than any other scientific discipline. And I think Darwin's theory has something to do with that. The evolutionist mindset was on public display late last year at a conference on religion and science at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. According to the New York Times, one participant described the conference thus. With a few notable exceptions, the viewpoints have run the gamut from A to B. Should we bash religion with a crowbar or only with a baseball bat? Now, it may be correct that a more modest Darwinism that does not insist on evolution being undirected would be harmless, but then it also would no longer be Darwinian. Conservatives cannot resolve the problems raised by Darwinian evolution merely by offering their own idiosyncratic definition of the term that Darwinian biologists themselves do not accept. Now, Darwinian conservatives, like Professor Arnhart and James Q. Wilson, believe that properly understood, Darwin's theory can be used to support moral universals and temper utopian schemes. But I think their argument flies in the face of both Darwinism's internal logic and an historical record that demonstrates the opposite. For the past 100 years, mainstream Darwinists, not just fringe Darwinists, but the mainstream of Darwinian theory, mainstream Darwinists have used Darwin's theory to promote relativism and the very utopianism that Professor Arnhart is against. Of course, these Darwinists could have been wrong in their applications of the theory, but I think a strong case can be made that their efforts were logically connected to the teachings of the theory. If one believes that all human behaviors are equally the product of natural selection and that all they ultimately exist all because they promote biological survival somehow, it's hard to see an objective ground for condemning any particular behavior that exists. The maternal instinct is natural according to Darwinism, so is infanticide. Monogamy is natural, but so are polygamy and adultery and even rape. If a certain man prefers 5 wives to 1, who are we to judge? Obviously, natural selection has preserved that desire for multiple wives in that male, so polygamy must be right for him. Same argument can be made for rape and a variety of other things. I'm not quarreling here with the attempt by Dr. Arnhart to enlist biology to support traditional morality. I actually agree that showing a biological basis for certain moral desires could conceivably reinforce traditional morality, but only if we have reason to assume that those biological desires are somehow normative. And that assumption, I think, is challenged frontally by Darwinian theory. If one believes, on the other hand, that natural desires have been implanted in human beings by intelligent design, or even that they represent an irreducible and unchanging truth inherent in the universe that we can rationally apprehend, I think then it's rational to accept those desires, those biological desires, as a grounding for a universal code of morality. But Darwinism explicitly denies that natural desires are either the result of intelligent design or an unchanging human nature. According to the Darwinian view, nature may, on occasion, sanction certain traditional virtues because at the moment they happen to promote biological survival. But even Darwin would acknowledge, if pressed, that given a different set of circumstances, a radically different conception of morality would be required. At one point in The Descent of Man, he said as much. If, for instance, men were reared under precisely the same conditions as hive bees, there can be hardly a doubt that our unmarried females would, like the worker bees, think it a sacred duty to kill their brothers, and mothers would strive to kill their fertile daughters, and no one would think of interfering. Although this startling passage refers specifically to the behavior of bees, it's making a point about human morality. After all, the book in which it appears is called The Descent of Man. And Darwin's point was how even human morality ultimately is a function of the conditions for survival. Whenever those conditions change, Darwin seems to say, so too will the maxims of human morality. Hence, relativism is perfectly rational within the Darwinian universe. Similarly, if one believes that human progress is dependent on a vigorous struggle for existence, as Darwin did, again, he outlines this in The Descent of Man, then any diminishment of natural selection in human society will raise legitimate concerns, and efforts to reinstate selection through eugenics may well appear rational. In addition, once one understands the evolving nature of human nature, it's difficult to see any in principle objection to efforts to transform human nature radically through bioengineering. Professor Arnhart attempts to outline in his book a Darwinian argument against radical human bioengineering, but I think his argument is less than persuasive. Our desires have been formed by natural selection over evolutionary history to promote survival and reproduction, he writes. Knowing this should make us cautious about using biotechnology to radically change our evolved nature. But why? Natural selection, by all counts, is a messy, hit-or-miss process of dead ends and false starts. Why shouldn't human beings use their reason to direct their evolution in order to produce a new kind of human being? What is so sacrosanct about existing human dispositions and capacities in Darwinism, since they were produced by such an imperfect and purposeless process? Dr. Arnhart seems to want to clothe human nature with a kind of sacred awe that will restrain human beings from tinkering with it, But such awe is alien to the Darwinian mindset. In fact, in his autobiography, Darwin recounted how he had once had such feelings, but they had evaporated. He lamented, "I well remember my conviction that there is more to man than the mere breath of his body. But now the grandest scenes would not cause any such convictions and feelings to rise in my mind." Indeed, I think the very term human nature is pretty much a non sequitur in a Darwinian sense, at least in its traditional sense. Conservatives who would rather sit out the evolution controversy, I think, need to understand that the current debate is not primarily about religious fundamentalism, nor is it simply an irrelevant rehashing of certain esoteric points of biology and philosophy. Darwinian reductionism has become culturally pervasive and inextricably intertwined with contemporary conflicts over traditional morality, personal responsibility, sex and family life, and bioethics. Indeed, Darwinian reductionism ultimately undermines the idea of man as a rational being who is both free and accountable. As Harry Jaffa has argued, the attempt inherent in Darwinism to reduce man's humanity to the outcome of a blind struggle of material forces denies, in effect, the ground in nature and reason of man's personal and political freedom. Darwinism is also central to an important debate about the role of scientific expertise in American society that dates back to the Progressive Era, at least. Darwin's defenders have been at the forefront of promoting what might be called technocracy, the claim that scientific experts ultimately have the right to rule, free from the normal restraints of democratic accountability. Disparaging the wisdom of ordinary citizens and their elected representatives, many Darwinists essentially argue that public policy should be dictated by the majority of scientific experts without input from anyone else. Today, this bold assertion is made not just with regard to controversies over evolution, but concerning a host of other issues such as sex education, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research, cloning, and global warming. Those on the left declare that any dissent from liberal orthodoxy on any of these issues represents a war on science. In fact, there's a book titled The Republican War on Science that makes this precise argument. This effort to demonize normal democratic dissent in the area of science and public policy has been fomented by, among others, Fenton Communications, a far-left public relations firm for such groups as MoveOn.org, Planned Parenthood, and the American Trial Lawyers Association. With funding from the Tide Center, Fenton has set up a group bearing the Orwellian name of Campaign to Defend the Constitution, or DEFCON. According to DEFCON, good science just happens to equal the political agenda of the left, and anyone who says otherwise is a theocrat who opposes scientific progress. Of course, there's much that can be said in favor of the authority of scientific expertise in modern life. In an increasingly complex and technologically driven world, the need for scientific input on public policy would appear to be obvious. While this line of reasoning, I think, exhibits a surface persuasiveness, and I think we do need scientific input on things dealing with science and public policy, it also ignores the limits of scientific expertise. As C.S. Lewis pointed out in the 1950s, government involves questions about the good for man and justice, and what things are worth having at what price. And on these, a scientific training gives a man's opinion no added value. Technocracy poses a further difficulty. Experts can be wrong, sometimes egregiously. If the history of social Darwinism in politics shows anything, it's that scientific experts can be just as fallible as anyone else. What is true of individual scientists is often true of the scientific community as a whole. For example, eugenics was embraced for decades by America's leading evolutionary biologists, almost without exception, and such scientific organizations as the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Critics of eugenics, meanwhile, were roundly stigmatized as anti-science and religious zealots because many of them happened to be Roman Catholic or evangelical Protestants like the William Jennings Bryan that has been referenced. Yet these critics were the ones who turned out to be right, and the consensus view of science turned out to be wrong. As equal citizens before the law, scientists surely have every right to inform policymakers of the scientific implications of their actions, but they have no special right to demand that policymakers listen to them alone or to ignore dissidents in their own ranks. Even conservatives who accept Darwinian theory, therefore, I think, should think twice before embracing some of the more dogmatic claims to authority made by evolutionary biologists and their supporters today. Such claims have resulted in a concerted effort to shut down honest debate through caricatures and even intimidation. While evolutionists continue to portray themselves as the victims of fundamentalist intolerance, in most places today, it's the evolutionists who have turned the inquisitor. At George Mason University in Virginia, biology professor Carolyn Crocker made the mistake of favorably discussing intelligent design in one of her cell biology classes. She was suspended from teaching the class, and then her contract was not renewed. At the Smithsonian, evolutionary biologist Richard Sternberg, the editor of a respected biology journal, faced retaliation in 2005 after accepting for publication a peer-reviewed technical article favoring intelligent design. Investigators for the U.S. Office of Special Counsel later concluded that it's clear that a hostile work environment was created with the ultimate goal of forcing Dr. Sternberg out. At Iowa State University, astronomer Professor Guillermo Gonzalez has been vilified and demonized by his colleagues for co-authoring a book about the evidence for design in astronomy and cosmology, not even biology. These efforts to purge the scientific community of any critics of Darwin are fueled by increasingly toxic rhetoric on the part of some. Biology professor P.Z. Myers at the University of Minnesota, one of our homegrown Richard Dawkins, for example, says that, quote, it's time for scientists to break out the steel-toed boots and brass knuckles and get out there and hammer on the lunatics and idiots. The lunatics and idiots, of course, is anyone who opposes Darwin's theory or raises questions about it. Whatever one's personal view of Darwinian theory, I think that the current atmosphere of intolerance is unhealthy for science and it's unhealthy for a free society. Conservatives who are discomfited by the continuing debate over Darwin's theory need to understand that it's not about to go away. First, it's not going away because, yes, the accumulating discoveries of science, in my view, undercut rather than confirm the claims of neo-Darwinism. And it's not just people who subscribe to intelligent design. There are numbers of people, whether it be self-organization theorists or others who would classify themselves as evolutionists, but who are fundamentally at odds with the claims that natural selection and random mutation are sufficient to explain the development of life. Second, it's not going away because Darwinism fundamentally challenges the traditional Western understanding of human nature and the universe. And I think we see this in some of the debates over sex and family, over morality, over free will, which is an issue that we didn't get into, but that's also really something that a Darwinian framework provides is very hard to justify a robust view of free will and human responsibility. Finally, the debate over Darwin is not going away because free people don't like to be told that there are some questions they're not allowed to ask and there are some answers they're not allowed to question. If conservatives want to address root causes rather than just symptoms in the arena of science and culture, I think they need to join the debate over Darwinism, not scorn it or ignore it. Thank you.